good evening and welcome. It is great to see everybody here. Appreciate the very good attendance that we have this evening. I encourage you to take out a Bible and follow along. Make certain that what is said is in accordance to God's Word. I know that there is some excitement about tonight's lesson because of the title. I was going through the tracts in the back, and not a one of them was about cats. It's obviously not a common thing that we would use in Scripture, in a sermon. And that's because if you look through Scriptures, you're not going to find much about cats at all. And I've had a few people try to guess what the sermon might be about. And I didn't even think anybody would, but the last time somebody did, and they said, it's about the difference between cats and dogs. And we're supposed to be like dogs that like to follow and please, and not like cats that hate you and scratch you. Like, well, that's pretty good. That's not the lesson. You never had a chance. You really didn't. It's really just an illustration, and we'll get to it. And I hope that by the end of the lesson, you'll understand why the cats is included in the title. But really, we want to start off, and you'll notice it's bigger, disciples. We want to talk about that. I love teaching new Christians. I love teaching people that are just now learning the Bible. And when we do that, frequently they have questions that I think other people have, they just don't think to ask. And that one of the most common ones I get really is, what's a disciple? Because that's not language you and I use terribly often, but it finds itself in the Scriptures quite frequently. And it's important for us to know. Because Jesus, after he's been resurrected, as he's getting ready to ascend to heaven, he gives the Great Commission. And in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 19, he says, go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. He goes on in verse 20, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. The order there matters. And what Jesus has said is he wants his disciples to go off and make disciples. And by the very fact that he has told us that means two things. It means, one, we're supposed to be disciples. And two, we're supposed to go out and create disciples. You can't do that if you don't know what a disciple is. And I submit to you that through my experience, all too often, members of the Church of Christ have skipped a step. And we go straight to baptism. We want to get them in the water. We want to get them baptized for the forgiveness of their sins. And friends, it's an important thing. It's commanded. It's right here in the Great Commission. It is very, very important. We want to baptize people into Christ. But you don't do that until after you've made a disciple. Make a disciple, baptize, and then you teach them everything. That's the order. And we don't want to skip a step. All right, so in this regards to what is a disciple, on the most basic level, and we're going to start off on basic and we're going to get to more complicated as we go through. But on the most basic level, a disciple is one who follows a teacher. And it is very literal. It is somebody who literally goes wherever somebody else goes. You think about in the first century, you have Jesus on earth, and he's going from town to town to town, and people were literally following him from town to town to town. Wherever he went, I would go. That was a literal disciple. But we're looking for something more than that. That's at the most basic level. What we're looking for is somebody who is a believer of a master. Somebody who says, I want to be who you are, to think how you think, to do what you do. And it's not enough to just go where he went. If you look at Luke chapter 7 and verse 11, we see a contrast of people who are following him and disciples. They're separated. Luke 7 and verse 11, it says, soon afterwards he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large crowd. So you have a large crowd that's following him, but they're not really disciples. There's a separate group of them that are the disciples. And so some people are just going where Jesus went, listening to him, thinking about him, watching the things he does. And others have made a different step. And they've decided, I'm going to be like him. I'm going to follow him. I'm going to believe in him. And so they're all on the same road, going the same way, but some of them are disciples, and some of them are just going the same direction. We want to be disciples. Now, of those many disciples, and this is oftentimes the next question that gets brought up with new Christians, is, well, what then is an apostle? And really what happens is Jesus takes these disciples, and he has a whole lot of them, and one night he spends all night in prayer, and then afterwards he says, I pick 12 of you. And 12 of them become his apostles. They're just disciples with a special mission, a special purpose. That's just the simplest way of describing them. But for the disciples as a whole, what happens in Acts 11 and verse 26. In Acts 11 and verse 26, you have these disciples at the church of Antioch. It says, when he had found them, he brought him to Antioch, and for an entire year they met with the church and taught considerable numbers, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. And so now you have the disciples, and they have a new name, and they're Christians. And so you say, well, are we disciples or are we Christians? The answer is yes. Those are the same thing. A really interesting thing happens to me in this verse and in the rest of the Bible. Two things. One, the word that was used there to say called is an unusual word. It does not, almost every other time it is used, there's an implication of a divine calling. When Joseph is called out of Egypt, called down to Egypt, it was an angel who was telling him. And if you go back and you think about that in here, it's not just the people in the area are suddenly saying, hey, you know what, I just don't like calling them disciples anymore, let's call them Christians. It is more like God putting a stamp saying, this church right here has become what I want. This is the new name. This is my new people. That's significant to me. But you know what's weird is that this term disciples doesn't show up after the book of Acts. The rest of the epistles never shows up. I find that bizarre. But we don't really go by disciples anymore. We go by Christians. Not that it's a wrong term at all. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about what a disciple is as we get towards this illustration. In John chapter 8 and verse 31, Jesus talks about the idea of a true disciple, which suggests that there were people who might be false disciples, people who were claiming to follow Jesus but not really following him. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine. To be a true disciple is an ongoing process. It is not like baptism where one day in the past you've done something and then that's it in the past. Discipleship is something that is an ongoing process. If we continue in the Word, then we are truly disciples. In John chapter 13, verses 34 through 35, Jesus says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another even as I have loved you, and that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And so now we have discipleship is a matter of obedience, to love one another. And then in John 15 and verse 8, he says, my Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. So it's not about us saying I'm a disciple of Jesus, it's about us proving it. So we're going to do that by continuing in his word with love for one another and bearing much fruit. Okay. Now let's spend a little bit more time in Luke 14. I once was having a Bible study with four teenagers, high school students who were just graduating. And they were trying to figure out what they want to do spiritually in life. Do they want to become Christians? One of them was debating between being a Christian or being a witch. And that was her choice, you know, trying to figure out her life. And so I've gone through with them and I've talked to them about scriptures and I've talked to them about truth. And as they're making their decisions, what I said... was of such a nature that this adult Christian who was sitting there turned to these four kids and said, that's the worst sales pitch you'll ever hear. Because what I had done is I did not tell them about the great blessings of Christianity. I didn't tell them about the great promises. I told them about the challenges, the difficulties. I did what Jesus does here. In Luke 14 and verse 25, it says, "Now large crowds were going along with him, and he turned and said to them," I just want you to stop and think right there. He has a large crowd following him. Is that good? That's great! Isn't that the goal? We want a large crowd. So what Jesus is going to do is he's going to turn to them and say, "I'm so glad you guys are here. Here's this great message to keep you all here and bring more people." That's what he's going to do, right? That's not what he does. He speaks in such a way that it would most likely cause many of them to quit following him. Because he's not interested in numbers, but in quality. He wants people that are disciples, not just followers. Not just people who go where he goes, but people who truly believe in him and are dedicated to being like him. So now large crowds were going along with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." You can't be my disciple if you choose family over me. Now, we struggle with that word hate. The word hate, if you're looking at Vines, there's three definitions for hate. One is, oh, that's not good. I didn't write it down and my brain's going to go blank. Now, one is, I despise you. Without any quality, without any justification, I just hate you. You walk in the room and I'm like, argh! That's one term of hatred, and there's just no place for that within Christianity. The second definition is to have a justified despising of wickedness. And that's a term used frequently for God. That God hates things, and that's something Christians must have. But then there's this other one that doesn't have that vitriol in it at all. It's just making one choice over another. And if you put that in here, it just fits really well. It's you have to choose Jesus over family. And sometimes you have to make that choice right away. When I was preaching in Colorado, there was a young girl. She was in high school. Different girl. She wasn't a part of this table earlier. She came to understand the scriptures, and I talked to her about this, and she's coming to this moment where she's trying to decide if she wants to become a Christian, and she reveals something that her parents had told her. If you're baptized, you may not come home. Instant choice she had to make. She was baptized, and they held to their word. She was not allowed to go home. Now, they have since craved, and she has not. She has stood strong and been an amazing young woman. But Jesus is saying that we all have to be willing to make that decision. And sometimes we do. Some people come to Christ and they find out through his teaching, you're not allowed to be married to who you're married to. Sometimes we find out that there's a problem with our children. There's challenges that can be put in front of us, and Jesus is saying, if there's a choice between your family and me, you want to be my disciple, you have to pick me. He goes on. Verse 27, "Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." You have to be willing to set yourself aside. Your own life. Your own reputation. Your own health. He goes on. "For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish it, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So then, none of you could be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." Look, Jesus has three times in there said, you cannot be my disciple. You cannot be my disciple if you choose family over me. You cannot be my disciple if you choose yourself over me. And you cannot be my disciple if you choose your stuff over me. Now, we talk about this as a hypothetical, and we hope it's a hypothetical. I hope you never have to choose between your family and God. I hope that never happens, but it could. And it is a hypothetical here, but do you want to know, for this particular audience, this last one, you might have to give up all your stuff, wasn't much of a hypothetical for them? Because if they did choose to follow Jesus, at some point this great persecution is going to arise because of Saul. And the church is not going to have a lot of time. They're going to just have to leave everything and go. That's what it means to be a disciple. Nothing comes between me and him. Nothing. And Jesus is telling this to these people, not afterwards, but beforehand. Make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Get people to this point where they recognize, I follow him no matter what. And then they're ready to be baptized and saved and learn all about what he has to teach. So our goal is to create a people like this, rather than just get people in the water. All right, so now let's look over at Matthew chapter 10. As we go deeper into this idea of discipleship. Matthew chapter 10, verse 24 and 25. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher, and the slave like his master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign the members of his household? And so what we see here is this idea of a disciple is contrasted to slave, and thus teacher to master. And so a disciple is somebody who has a teacher and somebody who has a master. A disciple is somebody who submits, who says, he's above me, and he gets to make the rules. A disciple is somebody who imitates, says, he's my goal. I want to think like him. I want to be like him. And as a result, a disciple should expect the same treatment as him. Now, a fairly similar passage in Luke chapter 6 and verse 40. A pupil is not above his teacher, but everyone, after he has been fully trained, will be like his teacher. What is a disciple? That word, by the way, there in verse 40 where it says a pupil, that's the same word as disciple. It's talking about the same thing. What is a disciple? He's somebody who's in training to become something greater. Someone who's in training to become like the master. And so a person who wants to become a disciple is somebody who goes around and says, I really want to know how to play the guitar. And so you don't find somebody who doesn't know what a guitar is. You find the very best guitar player out there and you say, that's what I want to be. And so then you follow them and you say, teach me, teach me, teach me. Show me what to be. And that's being a disciple. And now here we're talking about seeking out the Son of God, seeking out somebody who really knows righteousness, somebody who is on the path to salvation, who has a relationship with God that you want. You say, that's who I'm going to be like. That's who I'm going to follow. Teach me, teach me, teach me. Train me. Disciples are people in training to become someone greater. Now, I gave an assignment to some young girls at church. And I asked them to draw something for me. And David, this is your moment. I've told David, the sermon now hinges on him. It's either going to fly or it's going to fail. We'll see right here. I need you to identify one of their drawings for me. Okay? What is that? Yeah. Okay. Now, did you only get that because I had it in the title?
Probably.
Oh. Ruined. I should have called on someone else. Seriously, David, is there nothing about that that makes you think cat?
Everything about it makes me think cat.
Really? Pick something.
Whiskers.
It has whiskers. Cats have whiskers.
Ears.
Cats do have ears. You're good at this. Okay, what else?
Tail.
It has a tail. And that's a really important one here because dogs don't have tails like that, right? Dogs have four legs like this has four legs, and they have a nose. But this has a very specific type of tail. So this is clearly a cat, right? Everybody here agree this is a cat? Is that a cat? What kind of cats do you guys have? That is not a cat. Cats are three-dimensional, moving, breathing creatures with fur. That is an imitation of a cat, a representation. And yet, despite the fact that it was done by an 11-year-old, we all recognize it as a cat. Now, as it turns out, this 11-year-old girl has sisters. One is younger than her, 10. And as the 11-year-old was handing me these pictures, she was apologizing for her drawing. I'm like, why are you apologizing? She said, my sister took the assignment more seriously. Her sister spent more time, put a little bit more effort in it, and this is big, she found a picture of a cat so that she could mimic it better. Now, what that told me was this was done from memory. And I'm like, that's great. Her one-year-younger sister gave me this. Is that a cat? Is that a cat? I like it. The first answer is yes, of course that's a cat. We look at that, we recognize it's a cat. But it's still, again, an imitation. But look what happened if you put more time. Look what happens if you put a pattern up and say, this is what I'm going to try to imitate. Now, they have another sister who's 5 years old, and I don't know that I actually asked her to do the picture, but she gave me one. And this is it. And I guess it's a cat. It's got eyes, whiskers, feet. It was not until I got there the morning of the sermon that I found out that she decided she was going to do her own assignment, and she gave me a dragon cat. And I'm like, that makes sense! Yes, horns, wings, I see it! Dragon cat. Well, I'm like, that doesn't work with my illustration quite as well. So, I went to my 5-year-old niece, and I went to her and I gave her the assignment. I said, I want you to draw me a cat. I want you to give me your very best cat. And this is what she gave me. Now, it's a little hard to see, I guess, here, but you can see the line right here, head up there, right? She decided to do a little bit more and, like, put her name on it. Molly Joe, that's her name. I'm really thinking she was going to save me, I hope. I hope that's what that was. And then she said, and my cat's pregnant. Because 5-year-olds have a different way of thinking about things, don't they? Is it a cat? It's still a cat. Now, I went online and I said, drawings of cats. And somebody found a book on how to draw cats and learning special techniques. And so they came up with something like this. Oh, yeah, that's good. And somebody else, they've been working really, really hard and they came up with this. And now that looks like, that looks like a photo, doesn't it? Is it a cat? Yeah. Is it a cat? No. It's still just an imitation. Now, after having seen these two pictures, should I go back to this individual and say, young woman, I'm disappointed in you because there are much better cats than what you've drawn? Should I do that? Would any of you do that? Would you do that to my 5-year-old niece and say, I'm so disappointed in your picture of a cat? No, why? Because they did the assignment. They gave me a cat. Friends, this is discipleship. And it's a journey. And you start off, and you can just get the very basic structure. Not of a cat in this case, but of Jesus. And there's just little parts of us, little parts of our life, little parts of the ways we're thinking that are like Him. But as we practice and as we grow and as we mature, we get a little bit better. And then we look at the pattern a little bit more and we get a little bit better. And then we get older and older and we keep working, we keep working, we keep working. And this is the journey of discipleship. You start at one place, you get to this place. We are in learning, in progress. And as we go through that progress, should these individuals be ashamed because they're not here? No. No, don't beat yourself up for the journey. We're in training. The apostles, when they're following Jesus, they have all sorts of problems. But they're in training. And they're getting better, and they're getting better, and they're getting better. We shouldn't be ashamed. There's an exception to that. And I haven't done it. I probably should. I should probably draw a cat and put it up there. And I should be ashamed. And you might think, well, that's because I'm being humble and I'm just you like other people's art but not your own. No, no, I really should be ashamed. Because I took a lot of art classes back in the day. Back in the day when teachers were teaching, I liked to draw. I used to be an artist of sorts. And over the last 30 years, I haven't done anything. So guess what? If I drew a cat today, it would be worse than the cat I drew 30 years ago. And if drawing a cat is everything that matters to your soul, if all that matters is that in the end we can draw a good cat, then I should be ashamed because I got distracted by other things. I got focused on work, and I got focused on softball, and I got focused on photography and other things when what really mattered was drawing a cat. And my cat didn't get better, it got worse. And if being an imitating Christ is the most important thing, then we should be ashamed if we go through time and we've gotten distracted, and rather than focusing on improving and growing, we just got focused on other things in the world and our image is worse than it was before. It may be better than that one, but we should still be ashamed because we didn't grow. We got worse. But if we are in the process of growth, anywhere in the process of growth, don't be ashamed. You're a disciple. This is what disciples do. We grow. We get better. We get closer and closer in our imitation. So what is it then that the disciples face? And I think this is so important because when you become a disciple, when you really get the concept, I'm going to be a disciple, what happens is you will not quit. No matter what you face. They faced persecution from men, and this may not be the best wording for things, but they faced suffering from God as well. Now, when people became Christians, they then suffered. They're now following God. Everything should be going great, right? That's not how it works. You follow God and you're going to suffer. You're going to suffer at the hands of men. In Acts chapter 8, it's Saul, the man who's going to later become an apostle. But he just sets his sights toward Christianity. He says, I'm going to wipe them out. I'm going to wipe you out. They went and they scattered, but they didn't quit. Because they're disciples. Disciples endure suffering. But it didn't stop there. There was a time when God struck down two of the members of the church. And I don't know that everybody understood why that happened. All they know is God struck them down. Peter had nothing to do with Ananias and Sapphira dying. He didn't reach over there and punch them. He didn't touch them. He was standing at a distance and God struck them down. God's after us. Should we quit? No, we're disciples. By the way, I would think maybe that would give you all the more reason not to quit. When you realize, oh, he really cares about what we do. We ought to be more careful, not less, not run. But I mean, there's a time when Paul gets bit by a snake. Should he quit? I mean, that's not a person. That's God letting that happen. There was a time when Paul says he spent a day and a night in the ocean. How long can you tread water? And how long would you do that and think, God can't be happy with me as the waves keep hitting him in his face? But you don't quit. Even if you face suffering from men or suffering from God. Disciples are going to face bad disciples. Just no way around it. In Acts chapter 6 and verse 1, the book of Acts is about the spread of the kingdom in the face of opposition. And so it gives all these different statements about the church kept growing, the church kept growing. But in between those statements is the various conflicts that they face. They face external conflict, persecution from the Jewish leadership, persecution from Saul. They face the persecution from God, if you will, if you'll accept that. They face God striking down Ananias and Sapphira, and it says the church kept growing. And they faced internal conflict, where the Christians stopped treating one another very well. And so in Acts chapter 6 and verse 1, it says, now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on part of the Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of food. I don't know exactly what that looked like, but the disciples had taken it upon themselves to make sure their widows were taken care of. And some widows would come forward and say, "Can I have some food?" And some Christian would say, "No. Because of where you're from, I'm not giving you your food. I'm going to give it to this person over here." Now, do you like that? I don't. That's disgusting. That's discouraging. Should we quit? Disciples don't quit. Disciples do not quit, even when the disciples around them are misbehaving. In Galatians chapter 2, we talked about this one just the other night. Galatians chapter 2, now it's Peter. And Peter is looking at some people and saying, "I won't eat with you anymore." I want you to think about that. That now is church leadership. That's an apostle. And if you're going to say that's an apostle, when the apostles stand up to speak, he's the one who speaks. And he's the one who's now wrong and misbehaving. Should we quit? Disciples don't quit, even when other disciples are misbehaving. And Matthew 15, verse 23, it's just slightly different. It's a little different word for disciple here. But there's a woman who is just desperately seeking Jesus' help because she has a demon-possessed child. And she does not run into the most compassionate disciples. He did not answer a word, and his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away because she keeps shouting at us. We can't stand this woman. Send her away. She's annoying. She's got a daughter who's cruelly demon-possessed. Where's their compassion?" Should she quit? We'll come back. Disciples, at some point in our life, we're going to face a doctrine we don't like, a teaching we don't agree with. But disciples don't quit. They keep following, even when they get something they don't like. So in Acts chapter 10, it's the example of Peter. And this is going to be the conversion of Cornelius, the conversion of the first Gentiles. And if you had asked the Christians at that time, the all-Jewish Christians, if that was an acceptable thing, their answer would have been a resounding no. No, we will not have those Gentile filth in our number. God needs to fix them. And so God gives Peter a vision, and in this vision, God brings forth all this food in front of Peter, and it's food that's defiled, it's food that's unclean, it's food that under the old law you're not allowed to eat. And God says, "Arise, kill, and eat." And Peter says to God, "No. I've never done it. I never will." 3 times God tells him that. Peter's got to fix himself. We all do at some point. At some point, we're all going to face something. Well, in Acts chapter 11, after Peter does accept what God has said and does do what God says to do, he goes over and those Gentiles are converted by God and not by Peter. They receive the Holy Spirit and Peter hasn't touched them. He comes back to the Jews in chapter 11 and they come together and say, "Peter, what are you doing?" And now Peter goes through and he has to tell them they're wrong. And they listen and they understand that Peter did not make this choice. He did not decide to convert Cornelius. He did not decide to go see Cornelius. He was being led. He was being told by God. And now they have this choice. Here's what we have always held, and here's what God has done. Which one will we choose? And disciples choose God. Him. And that's not easy. Just over a week and a half ago, I preached a sermon. And I think I may have made some mistakes in that sermon about my audience and my tone. I stand by the sermon. It was true, but I forgot some about my audience and I forgot some about the tone. And I was preaching a sermon on hate. A sermon on godly hate. Getting to a point where we hate sin the way God hates sin. And because of things that were going on in my life at that time, I had some illustrations. And it brought for a young woman who has just recently come through our doors and become a Christian, it brought her to this point harshly. Because in the sermon it becomes clear that some of those things that we're going to have to hate are things that the world says you should love. Some things we should be ashamed of, the world says we're proud of. And ding, 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 she starts thinking about what that means. And her brother's a homosexual. And she said, I wanted to get up and leave. And the only reason she didn't is because we lock our doors too. I said, they would have let you out. But that's the only reason why she did not storm out, was because the doors were locked. I said, let's go talk for a bit. So let's just talk. And there's no way that I can put this to her that's not going to fly in the face of everything she's been taught. And it's not going to fly in the face of her family, which she holds dear. I said, I'm going to give you some scriptures. I'm just going to send them to you. And I want you to read them for yourself so that you know what God has said. And then after that, you have to decide for yourself, can you accept it? So I sent her a long email with a lot of scriptures. And then I sat back and I confessed to you I had no hope. And I was wrong. She read the scriptures and she saw she had a situation. Here's what God clearly has taught. Here is my family, my beliefs, everything I've held dear, everything that is true about me, and I have to choose. She said, I'll see you Sunday. But we're all going to have to get to that point on some subject. Something is going to be in contrast to what we believe, to what we hold dear, and we're going to have to decide, do we follow ourselves or do we follow God? Well, why would disciples do all of this? Why don't they quit? Well, part of it's because we're following Jesus' example. So when we suffer, we're not like, oh no, God must hate us. This is what Jesus did. He came on earth and He suffered. And by the way, for that matter, did Jesus ever get told to do something He didn't want to do? What's He doing in the garden when His blood is like sweat and He's saying, let this cup pass from me? Does He want to get punched? Does He want to get scourged? Does He want to get impaled to a cross? No, but He does it anyway. And if we've set Him as an example, what are we going to do? Recognize we're going to get to those situations too. Because we're following His path. Disciples don't quit because the obstacles do not change who Jesus is. Whatever you face, whatever challenge, it doesn't change who Jesus is. And who Jesus is why we follow Him. So in Matthew chapter 15, verse 21 through 28, where you have that woman who has their cruelly demon-possessed child. It's not just the disciples who are behaving in a way that could have offended her. Jesus went away from there and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. And a Canaanite woman from the region came out and began to cry out, saying, have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed. Now look at that. I mean, it's just a passionate plea. Help! Have mercy! I've got a problem, and it's not me, it's my daughter. And all the parents can understand that, right? You can understand how desperate she is. But He did not answer a word. Now, couldn't that have offended her? He didn't even answer. And His disciples came and implored Him, saying, send her away because she keeps shouting at us. Now, couldn't that have offended her? They're all against me now. But He answered and said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, couldn't that have offended her? I'm not here for you. But she came and began to bow down before Him, saying, Lord, help me. And He answered and said, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Now, I don't think He's actually calling her a dog, but I know people can very easily misunderstand it and say, you just called me a dog. Shouldn't she quit trying? Why doesn't she? Two reasons. She still has a problem, and he's the only one who can fix it. So it doesn't matter how he's behaving. It doesn't matter whether it offends her. It doesn't matter how the disciples are behaving. She still needs him. Why do disciples not quit? Why do we not quit when preachers have affairs, when elders embezzle money, when the church leadership falls into all sorts of disrepair and all sorts of problems, when there's gossip and people are mistreating one another within the church? Why do we not quit? Because we still have a problem and God's the only solution. You can't go anywhere else. Now, you may go to a different church. Maybe that happens. But I mean, you can't leave the church. You can't leave Christ. You can't leave His body because He's the only solution for your problem. It doesn't matter how everybody else is behaving. Why do we come to Jesus and keep following Him when He starts teaching things we don't like? Because we haven't come to tell Jesus what the truth is. We've come to learn from Him what the truth is. Disciples come to learn. If we come to Jesus and expect Him to change His doctrines to us, we're not disciples. We're saying to Jesus, "You follow me." That won't work. So Matthew chapter 11 and verse 28 in the great invitation. What does Jesus say? It's actually verse 29 that we want, but "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me." I'm going to teach, and you're going to learn. And we understand from Matthew 10 and verse 24 that we're not better than the master. We're not better than the teacher. When we come to Jesus, we have to have an understanding that says, "I'm wrong about something. I don't know what I'm doing. I need to learn." So we don't come holding our doctrines and holding our traditions and holding our beliefs. We come sacrificing them, saying, "Teach me what I need to know. Tell me what to let go of, what to hold on to, where to go and what to avoid." We understand from Isaiah 55 verses 9 through 9. You have to start there, go back up. No, but you understand from there where God says, "My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. My thoughts are higher than yours." We come to God and we follow Him because we know He's better than us. That means if He teaches something we don't agree with, we don't fight. Disciples change. They let go. And they follow. Why do disciples not quit? Because ultimately, we want to get where Jesus is. We're following Jesus. And we're following Him because He's the most righteous one. He knows about righteousness. We're following Him, though, because He has the relationship with God. We're following Him because He gets to where we want to go. He got to heaven. Where is He right now? At the right hand of God. He is in heaven. And you follow Him to get to where He's at. And if you're not there, it doesn't matter what you're facing. It doesn't matter what you're enduring. You keep following Him because you're still not where you need to get. And no amount of suffering in this life is going to change where Jesus is. No amount of misbehaving Christians in this life is going to change where Jesus is. No amount of doctrines you don't like is going to change where Jesus is. And so we still follow. We do not quit. So I call on you to be a disciple. Somebody who will learn from Jesus, who will imitate Jesus, and who won't beat themselves up on the journey. We are going to be improving. And if you are improving, fantastic. But should you be satisfied? No. Those girls shouldn't be satisfied with their pictures. They should improve. But they shouldn't beat themselves up. Just grow. Slowly. But grow. And ultimately, never quit. And then friends, I want you to turn right around once you've done that, and I want you to say, "That's what I need to create in other people. That's what I'm trying to establish." When Jesus sends them out, says, "I have all authority. Here's what I want you to do." He does not say, "I want you to go get a bunch of people." Does He want a bunch of people? Oh, absolutely. But it's not the quantity, it's the quality, right? He wants us to make disciples and baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. So let us focus on Jesus rather than the water. What the world needs to understand is they need to follow Jesus. They need to understand who He is and why to follow Him. And then after that, we can talk about baptism. And we need to show that Jesus is from God and has authority over everything. And we need to take a moment, because discipleship is going to be hard. At the very, very beginning, don't lie. Don't hide it. Make a disciple means let them know you've got to count the cost. Because you never know how quickly they'll have to make that decision. It may be the moment they come up from the water, or it may be just a few weeks afterwards when the preacher pushes an issue. You never know, but it will come. We have to prepare them first. That's the order God set. I sure appreciate your time and your attention. And I hope that at the end you understand why this sermon was called Disciples and Cats. To me, that is such a helpful illustration to really understand how I shouldn't beat myself up in this journey. And you shouldn't either. If you're not a Christian, that first thing you have to decide is, do I believe in Jesus and am I willing to follow Him? And I hope you understand from this message what that means. And I'm not trying to scare you away, and I'm not trying to tell you it's not worth it. It absolutely is worth it. But you've got to know it's going to be a hard road, but it's worth it. If you're not a Christian, you can become one this morning, this evening, this now, right now. You can take a front seat and be baptized into Christ. Have your sins all washed away if you're ready to be a disciple. If you're a Christian and you've fallen away, we encourage you to come back. Get back on track of growth rather than the shameful going backwards. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?